You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Hey, listeners, and welcome back to National Security Law Today. Last week, Elisa sat down with Tyler O'Connor, partner at Crowell & Mooring and former energy counsel to the House Energy and Commerce Committee, to discuss how the One Big Beautiful Bill is reshaping U.S. energy incentives and pushing the private sector to rethink its strategy. This week, we turn to the National Defense Authorization Act. Elisa and Tyler unpack how this sweeping legislation could shift how the Department of Defense, Congress, and key agencies approach energy, from crypto and AI to clean power and grid resilience. As always, thanks for tuning in, and here's Elisa.
So let's move away for a minute from the OBBB and let's talk a little bit about the NDAA since we are a national security podcast. You know, we've had guests on who talked about the amount of fuel that it took to move a tank a mile in the Middle East during various Gulf Wars, and it's beyond anything you could imagine. Now we're looking at this sort of shift in energy policy. I'm wondering how any of that landed in the NDAA, if it did. Did you see it there? What did you notice?
Yeah. So first, we should note that as of this podcast, NDAA is not final and has not passed. Typically, NDAA passes by the end of the year, very often in December. To me, kind of the most interesting provisions, at least as an energy lawyer, primarily relate to nuclear energy and to critical minerals. Perusing through at least the Senate version of NDAA, you know, I found it interesting that it would establish an advanced nuclear energy working group, which essentially would be a working group of senior defense officials who are supposed to be responsible for expediting and overseeing the development and deployment of nuclear energy technologies, including the procurement of commercial advanced nuclear capabilities. So, you know, basically the next generation of nuclear fission reactors. DOD has very often been on the forefront of kind of the energy transition and has first exposure because of its global supply chains when there are either supply chain difficulties or difficulties transporting energy in whatever form it's in. So I found this effort to establish an advanced nuclear energy working group to not only be a good indication of the times, it's only in the last few years that nuclear energy has really had a renaissance in the United States. They're reopening what was formerly Three Mile Island, you know, Crane Energy Center in Pennsylvania. There have been a number of offtake agreements executed between large data center companies and hyperscalers and nuclear power plants. And I think this demonstrates that DOD itself is getting into the game, or at least has already been in the game, and doesn't want to be left behind. So they too are figuring out how do they accelerate the procurement of kind of these advanced nuclear capabilities. I think that's consistent, as I said, with the administration's broader agenda. We have seen them undertake a number of actions, including executive orders intended to expedite the licensing of nuclear power plants. And then I think the other interesting piece has been in the critical minerals and rare earth space and in the supply chain space. You know, much as the OBBB adopts foreign entity restrictions for companies that want to claim tax credits, the draft NDAA language would prohibit, for instance, the procurement of certain rare earths from non-allied foreign nations. And it has a number of provisions that would impose additional supply chain constraints on DOD that are intended to limit their exposure to China and other foreign adversaries. And so when you look at what's happening on the domestic side in domestic energy politics, where we have the adoption of foreign entity restrictions and the promotion of nuclear energy, I think we're seeing something very similar in the defense space and as manifested in NDAA.
Let's talk for a second about these agencies that you have to interface with. The first one is FERC. So a lot of our listeners are going to be young. They don't know what is FERC's authorities. What do they look like? What can they do? What are they supposed to be doing? And what's changed because we have a new administration?
So FERC itself, you know, we've seen a few things happen already this year. And I think we can kind of get a sense of where things are going. Chairman Phillips is no longer the chair. And the president did not renominate Chairman Christie, giving President Trump the opportunity to appoint two new commissioners to FERC. One, Laura Swett, has been in the energy industry and worked at FERC, so she's well known in the energy space. Whereas the other, and I apologize to him if I mispronounce his last name, David Lacerte, does not have, as I understand it, as robust an energy background and comes from the Office of Personnel Management. So while I think many people expect his views to be kind of consistent with the administration's priorities, we're still waiting to learn more. Over the past few months, FERC has already confronted a number of thorny policy questions with more to go. Most of them deal with how to address load growth from AI and data centers. And I think so far that's manifested in several issues that have presented themselves, including questions about the best way to incentivize and process the interconnection of new power plants, and questions about the co-location of large loads with generating facilities. And how do you ensure grid reliability and a fair allocation of costs? There are a number of pending proceedings before the commission on those topics, and there are regional grid operators who themselves are considering how to address, for instance, the large load interconnection process and make sure that we bring enough resources online quickly enough so that we can meet these growing challenges.
I always find it interesting that there is a Department of Energy. And there have been in the past candidates, and more than one, by the way, that had no idea what it is that the Department of Energy even does. So can you talk about that a little bit and what has shifted with the new administration?
Yes, there's at least one very famous example of a Secretary of Energy or a future Secretary of Energy not knowing what DOE does. But in their defense, and in the defense of everybody who doesn't know what DOE does, it does a lot of things, and those things change under each administration. And I think that's what we've seen most particularly during the Biden administration, when DOE took on a newer role, and something that we've seen as President Trump and Secretary Wright have changed DOE's focus. So how did it take on a new role during the Biden administration? For a long time, DOE made investments in research and development. And there was a perspective, I think, amongst many people that commercialization and deployment were best left to the private sector. Now, there were some notable exceptions to that, including investments made under the Recovery Act under President Obama and the establishment of the Loan Programs Office Section 1703 Loan Guarantee Program. However, the Infrastructure Bill and the Inflation Reduction Act provided DOE with a lot of resources to invest in grants and loans in energy infrastructure. And they established entire new offices, including the Office of Clean Energy Demonstrations, bring on personnel and make those investments. What we have seen, you know, over the course of the Biden administration, what we saw is kind of the robust growth of DOE into this agency that was really involved in making investments, whether it was in the electricity grid through the Grid Deployment Office, or in carbon capture and storage through grants, or other types of technologies that the administration wanted to incentivize. The Trump administration has taken a very different approach. To date, they have terminated some of those grants. They have sent requests for information out to a number of other grant recipients, essentially focusing on whether those grants are consistent with the current administration's priorities. And instead of focusing on doling out resources, they have focused on using, for instance, their emergency authorities under Section 202C of the Federal Power Act. And in so doing, have used that authority to keep two coal projects online past their planned retirement dates. And they seem very focused on figuring out how do they leverage DOE resources to address what they view as a forthcoming resource adequacy shortfall. Resource adequacy just being the fancy name for not having enough power to meet demand. So I think what the agency is doing is somewhat reverting, in fact, to its more traditional, you know, non-grant making role. Although I defer to your listeners as to whether they think that's good or that's bad.
Right. But also under DOE is a lot of regulation and oversight of nuclear and fissile material, right?
It does. And that is one of the most important, least known roles that it has is managing the U.S. nuclear weapons stockpile.
Let's talk about what is sort of happening right now. There are priorities in this administration on AI. And, you know, they had, all the tech pros at the inaugural ball, and they're all doing something. They're in an AI competition with one another right now. But obviously, that requires an enormous amount of energy. So I wonder if some of these changes that we're seeing are sort of directed at AI development plus. And by plus, I mean there's a second thing that's on the horizon out there, which is this sort of sudden embracing of cryptocurrencies, which require vast computing power in order to mine cryptocurrency. And that also takes a tremendous amount of energy. Do you get the sense that it's more than just AI that is directing this?
You know, I think there's a convergence of trends, AI and data center growth being the most prominent. But we've also seen a substantial reshoring of American manufacturing over the last few years. And President Trump has made continuing to reshore American manufacturing part of his agenda. And I can say, having worked with a lot of what we call large loads, large commercial and industrial companies that are really energy intensive, and that can be anything from data center to a mine to steel production, all of those companies need power. And the way they compete globally, in part, is by trying to procure reliable power at a low cost. Well, I think, you know, you're correct to identify that AI and data center load growth is a significant contributing factor to kind of our changing energy policy landscape. You know, there's a number of industries which are power hungry and which we want to feed because we want to bring these things back to the United States. We want more manufacturing, and we're not going to be able to do that unless we can provide power at a low cost. Whether cryptocurrency does or does not play a role, you know, I think there have been some notable examples of cryptocurrencies' thirst for electricity, but I don't have a real sense of whether that is kind of the tail wagging the policy dog or not.
I did notice something today in one of the major newspapers that referenced the fact that there was a sudden water shortage after data centers sprung up in a particular area of the country, that suddenly people living there were having trouble turning on their taps and getting water. And I think this has come up in a number of discussions with energy lawyers and scientists about sort of secondary, tertiary consequences of some of these moves. And that, you know, we're doing this quickly, we're in a competition, we certainly want to beat China in any advent development of any new technology that has a wonderful and frightening potential at the same time. But the idea that we could, you know, further marginalize a lot of citizens in this country who then couldn't get access to energy really is alarming to me. And I hope that there's a lot of consideration going into that. I obviously don't track what's happening on the Hill, but I have no doubt that those conversations are occurring because I hear conversations like that in other contexts. So I certainly hope so. I hope you're hearing that, Tyler.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of conversations, but like many things on Capitol Hill, you know, you show two different people with two different philosophical perspectives, the same set of facts, and they reach two different and sometimes opposite conclusions. And I think that's what we saw in part in the OBBB. Is I think what you heard from Democrats is Democrats saying we need more electricity and we need it to be inexpensive. And so we should not be stripping tax credits from companies that are producing electricity. If you want more of something, you know, give it a tax credit. If you want less of it, then tax it more. And I think what you heard from Republicans is, yes, we need more electricity, but really specific types of electricity, not that electricity, this electricity. And so I think that's manifested kind of in what we saw come out of the OBBB. I think most reports that have come out, you know, we anticipate that these tax credit changes will raise electricity rates and will slow down the deployment of renewable resources. I certainly hope that's not the case. But, you know, to your point, a lot of people can be having the same conversation, but reach two very different conclusions.
And that's certainly the case. And it's obviously the case throughout this country, even though I would say most Americans agree on most things. We now imagine ourselves to be sort of irreparably fractured. And I think anybody looking at Congress right now would assess them similarly. But what do you think this is going to do, though, for the green sort of energy push that was underway? Because, you know, even if all of this is occurring, one would like to believe that there will continue to be a development of green energy. Because at some point, we're going to need it. The planet continues to warm. We continue to have all sorts of issues. And I know they're not perfectly addressed by things like battery-operated vehicles. But what are you seeing? And based on your experience, what are you thinking about what is going to become of this, what was arguably at least becoming a robust movement?
I'd probably fall somewhere in the middle of the two camps. You know, there's that famous Mark Twain quote, reports of my death are greatly exaggerated. On the one hand, I think that reports or analysis indicating that the age of renewable electricity is over are incorrect. I think it continues to provide benefits, both in terms of, as I said, its speed that it can interconnect to the grid and provide inexpensive electricity. I think those benefits are still material and they will continue to drive investments in renewable energy. But if the question is, does the OBBB and other recent policy changes, are they going to have a material negative impact on the industry in the short term, then I think the answer is yes. I think there's no question that taking tax credits away from projects that were in development, and these are, you know, sometimes very capital intensive projects, I think that is bad for business. It creates regulatory uncertainty in the future as well, because I think if companies don't know that tax credits or regulations as they exist can be relied on, then they build in an inherent risk premium that increases costs for projects and makes them more expensive. And those costs either result in projects not being built, or it makes them more expensive and those costs get passed downstream. So I think ultimately, you know, there are some red flags for the renewable electricity industry. I think at the same time, we're seeing, no doubt, as you mentioned right at the outset of this podcast, proposals for new gas generation to come online, geothermal, nuclear, including some advanced nuclear technologies that we'll see if they reach commercial viability. The resource mix may change. The IRA put its thumb on the scale in favor of clean energy resources, and recent changes by this administration and Congress put their thumb on the scale of thermal resources. I think folks who supported the IRA and worked on it, like I did, would agree with that. And I think folks in the Trump administration would agree with that. But I think at the end of the day, you know, I revert back to the cliche I said earlier, and that has been undoubtedly overused, which is, you know, an all of the above energy strategy. And I still think that's where we shake out after all of this. We shake out in a world where clean energy just provides innumerable benefits that thermal resources do not provide. And thermal resources provide benefits that renewable resources don't provide. That's why I think a lot of grid planners and others often prefer a mix. And I think, you know, I have companies, including, you know, large commercial and industrial loads who rely on a variety of resources. And I think that's ultimately where we're going to end up at the end of the day, because that's just where the economics make the most sense.
I wish there were incentives in place, profit motives that would sort of shift the entire topography of what we're looking at right now. Yeah, obviously, I'm a fan of renewable energy for a lot of reasons, but one of them is that it doesn't cost very much once you get the panels up. Obviously, we're living that life right now. But I think separate and apart from that, many times throughout humanity, we've faced the brink of disaster, and then there's been some sort of scientific development. The principal concern that I have right now, if we're waiting for that invention to ride in on a white horse, I don't think it's going to happen, because we're not devoting enough resources to trying to solve the problem of climate anyway, and not in a tit for tat over energy policy. But I feel that there has to be some sort of new research on how we might deal with this scientifically, what some sort of new breakthrough. I'm not saying that there's going to be a perfect carbon capture solution, because you then have to do something with carbon. But it would be nice if there was something that we haven't anticipated, because history's shown that we often anticipate the worst and we frequently turn short of the absolute disaster.
Yeah, that's well said. I mean, I think that, you know, there are a number of companies performing cutting-edge research, commercializing cutting-edge technologies, both in the nuclear and non-nuclear spaces. And so I don't think that a new technology or a paradigm-shifting technology is out of our reach. But I think it's important that we continue investing in this funding for science and research and development and commercialization of these technologies. You know, one of the important programs that was funded in the Inflation Reduction Act was programs run by the Loan Programs Office, which I've mentioned several times during this discussion. That office was basically founded to respond to a very specific problem, which is a promising technology that was too risky for private banks to invest in, to loan money to, but that the government thought it could take the risk because that technology would be in the long-term interests of our national energy policy. You know, the Loan Programs Office, I think most famously, funded Tesla over a decade ago. You know, the OBBB defunds a lot of the funding that was allocated to that program. But, you know, to your point, yes, we need breakthroughs and we need scientific breakthroughs, but we also need to do something with them. And if we don't have the resources and invest the time and the resources and the effort into commercializing these technologies and making them widely available, well, then they make a great theoretical project and maybe somebody wins a Nobel, but it doesn't ensure that an AI data center is getting inexpensive electricity so that it can, and reliable electricity so it can operate 24/7. And it doesn't keep the lights on at a hospital. And it doesn't do all of the wonderful things that energy can facilitate. You know, I've heard a quote several times from a gentleman here in DC who says, energy, or maybe it's electricity, is only 5% of the economy, but it's the first 5%. And now I don't know if it's really 5% of the economy, but I think his point is that without electricity and without energy, nothing else operates. Everything in our modern society is predicated and on an abundant and comparatively inexpensive source of electricity. And so I think as policymakers, whether they're at the White House or in Congress or at the agencies or state public service commissions, think about energy policy. That is the lodestar they should keep in mind, is how do we make sure we're incentivizing the abundant deployment of energy so that we can do all the other wonderful things that rely on it.
I think that's right, Tyler. I am really glad that we got a chance to talk tonight. But before we go, I want to ask you what you think we should be looking for in terms of possible legislation over the next 3 years.
Well, 3 years is a long time, but I think there will be another attempt made at permitting reform. You know, there have been previous attempts made in previous Congresses, including the most recent Congress. I would expect some folks at least to try and pick up the pen again and see if they can get that across the line. You know, we might have said AI and data centers over 100 times. And that is not something I should note. If we had this podcast episode 3 years ago, that either of us probably would have mentioned even once. And that is part of my reluctance for predicting legislative, you know, reforms over the next 3 years. But it is the issue on the forefront of everybody's mind. And so I would also not be surprised. I believe there's going to be an AI Action Day this week being hosted by the White House, where they will issue some executive orders, perhaps on permitting, perhaps on other issues, to make it easier to facilitate, you know, getting energy to data centers that need them. I wouldn't be surprised if Congress also takes up that mantle sometime in the next few years. And so I think those are really the two places, you know, permitting and getting a better handle on AI and the energy demands of AI, and then perhaps formulating a more kind of coherent policy as to how we address this issue across the country.
Well, it'll be interesting to see where we are and whether or not data centers continue to expand, because the way they're expanding right now, you can see them physically, and there are so many of them. I can't imagine, there has to be a cap to this at some point. I'm wondering what it would look like physically and energy-wise. And it's nothing that I am equipped scientifically to predict either. But I think whatever develops in science will ultimately drive the legislation, as well as sort of how things unfold in these current conflict zones and in the relationship with China, which doesn't seem this week to be on the uptick. But anyway, Tyler, I'm really glad that you came in and talked to us tonight. And it was great to hear your views on this and to get your wisdom on what we're seeing in the OBBB and the NDA, and to sort of better understand a little bit about how Congress and some of these regulatory agencies are shifting when it comes to energy policy. And we hope you'll come back again and join us in the future.
Well, I really appreciate the invitation. I appreciate you hosting me. I love the podcast, and I look forward to coming back in the future as kind of these energy trends evolve.
Well, sounds great. All right. Our guest tonight has been Tyler O'Connor of Crowell and Mooring. And I want to thank you for listening to NSLT. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on your listening app of choice. If you would do us a solid and go ahead and rate us, we'd appreciate that. If you like our long form podcasts, Give us a like and rate us, of course. Remember to share us. All these things trigger the algorithm and they amplify our podcast, bring more listeners. And we hope they also bring people in who want to have thoughtful conversation instead of disappearing into social media silos and staying angry, because I think we're all pretty sick of that. And we want to move forward as a country, and certainly as lawyers, we definitely want to see some more discourse and thought. But we also encourage you on this podcast to listen to other people's point of view. If you're a lawyer, a law student, especially a young lawyer, a law student, you need to understand that if you can't understand the other party's point of view and hear their argument thoroughly, you're ill-equipped to respond to it. It may be hard. You may be accustomed to cage fighting, but it's not going to work for you in the long term if you're not understanding what your opponent is actually saying. And remember something else, a key feature of our national security is the fact that we have a unity, whether or not you believe it or right now, we do, in a country that still has more diversity of thought than any other. If you haven't traveled, you might want to trust me on this, but when you do and you see the rest of the world, you begin to understand what I'm saying. So thanks for listening tonight. Our writer, producer, and host is me, Elisa Poteet. I am forever and always here in my individual capacity. NSLT's co-producer and editor is the lovely Frances Burkham. My other co-producer is the ever amazing, never needs to sleep, never stops, Holly McMahon, the director of the committee, as well as all of the thoughtful and brilliant lawyers at the Nonpartisan Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would not be possible. We'll see you next time with a little bit more on energy and national security.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.